Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Just a comment about my opinions. My Bachelor's of Science degree included extensive training in reviewing medical and scientific papers and looking for errors in both reasoning and methodological flaws. I receive no income from advertising, product endorsement, or other support for this podcast. I am a courageous woman of principle who makes up her own mind. If I do not agree with your opinion, it is because I do not agree that the evidence supports your conclusions. If your response to that is an ad hominem personal attack on my integrity, it only betrays the weakness of your argument. So, we're going to spend a little time talking about science, and I mean science with a big S, the kind that tries to understand deep principles of how things work, not the kind that's looking for a product to patent. I'm going to read you an essay from Nature Journal's news section. Don't worry, I've abbreviated it, but it makes some excellent points. I'm paraphrasing an article by Paul Nurse called "Biology Must Generate Ideas as Well as Data." Accepting a Nobel Prize nearly two decades ago, my old friend Sidney Brenner had a warning for biology. "We are drowning in a sea of data and starving for knowledge," he said. That admonishment from one of the founders of molecular biology, who established the nematode worm, C. elegans, as a model organism, is even more relevant for biology today. Rather often, I go to a research talk and feel drowned in data. Some speakers seem to think that they must unleash a tsunami of data if they are to be taken seriously. The framing is neglected, along with the why the data are being collected. What hypotheses are being tested? What ideas are emerging? Researchers seem reluctant to come to biological conclusions or to present new ideas. The same occurs in written publications. It's as if speculation about what the data might mean and the discussion of ideas are not quite proper. I have a different view. Description and data collection are necessary but insufficient. Ideas, even tentative ones, are also needed along with the recognition that ideas will change as facts and arguments accumulate. Why are researchers holding back on ideas? Perhaps they're worried about proposing an idea that turns out to be wrong, because that might damage their chances of getting a promotion or funding. But, as Charles Darwin put it, false facts are highly injurious to the progress of science, for they often endure long. But false views, if supported by some evidence, do little harm, for everyone takes a salutary pleasure in proving their falseness. And when this is done, one path towards error is closed, and the road to truth is often at the same time opened. To wit, it's important to get the facts right. But new ideas are useful, as long as they are based on reasonable evidence and are amenable to correction. Don't get me wrong, we need data produced from new technologies to advance understanding. The importance of hypothesis-free research is well established. The philosopher Francis Bacon proposed it as part of his empirical method in 1620. In his book, Novum Organum, he argued that the first step in establishing scientific truth should be the description of the facts through systematic observation. But this is only the first step. For example, it would have been rather a pity if Darwin had stopped thinking after he had described the shapes and sizes of finch beaks and had not gone on to propose the idea of evolution by natural selection. The next step in the scientific process is to extract knowledge from the data. To refocus on that goal, we must improve our working processes, placing a greater emphasis on theory and shifting our research culture. How? Embed engineers and experimentalists who are developing new technologies and methods deeply into biological problems. It is through deep familiarity with biology, not simply a drive to collect more and more data, that important questions will be asked. Such questions will sustain the investigator's passion to keep probing until patterns and knowledge emerge, and will also influence the data that are gathered. There are other necessary steps. Develop appropriate analytic tools, including programs for data mining and machine learning. Make certain that data are usable, properly annotated, and openly shared. Model the molecular and cellular components involved in a biological phenomenon to allow analysis of dynamic behaviors and interactions. More theory is needed. My exemplars for this include the evolutionary biologists Bill Hamilton and John Maynard Smith, and the geneticists Barbara McClintock and Francis Crick. A few Nobel Prize winners there, parenthetically, by the way. Their papers are permeated with richly informed biological intuition, which makes them a delight to read. This sort of thinking will accelerate a shift from description to knowledge. Theorists can find fertile ground in considering the flow of information through living systems, which can help them make sense, better sense, of the flood of biological data. Seeking to be led by theory and knowledge will probably require shifts in research culture. Theorizing should be encouraged, and theories should be included in experimental papers to put data into context. Attempts to do this should not be dismissed as editorial or by funding processes as idle speculation. As Darwin said, it allows ideas to be attacked and either dismissed or modified. A sort of tyranny of the field sometimes inhibits the generation of explanations different from the current consensus. But this is a big mistake. If the new ideas are not satisfactory, then they will soon be eliminated and progress will be made. False facts should not be tolerated, but journals and research funders should be open to reasonable new ideas and interpretations, particularly if they differ from the current consensus. Evaluation committees should be tolerant when some of the ideas of people they are considering for promotion or funding are shown to be incorrect. Such approaches will advance not only research, but also teaching. Students will be better motivated and will feel more inspired if they are taught that biology has ideas and that they are worth talking about. Now it's me talking, Dr. Dawn. I think this could be applied to any of the sciences. I really do. And I think we are in danger of becoming academic guilds, and particularly the paywalls. We need to be freely sharing information. One of the great things that happened during COVID, one of those COVID bonuses, the so-called silver linings, is that at least in COVID research, the paywalls came down, and anybody anywhere could read the literature without having to pay for it. That made for a huge bunch of ideas that didn't hold up, but it also made for rapid progress, which has gotten us very far in a critical situation, saving many, many lives, uncounted lives, and likely to save more. So to those who criticize the NIH or the FDA or the public health system for revising their recommendations over time, well, clearly such individuals miss the point that this is what science does. Over and over and over again. This is how we make progress. This is how we get ever closer, although Zeno's paradox will prevent us from ever getting there. We get ever closer to the truth. And I just got one, so we're going to open that up. And this is a cold read, folks, so forgive me if I stumble. I am a 75-year-old female whose primary care physician is concerned about my cholesterol of 242, as well as my calculated LDL of 180. My cholesterol to HDL ratio was 5.6. My cardiac calcium score has been zero two times, and in my very recent mammogram, there was no sign of calcium deposits. My high blood pressure is under very good control, and I'm not diabetic or overweight. No recent history of heart attack or stroke. Diet is pretty decent. He suggested three treatment ways to go treatment-wise: pravastatin, rosuvastatin, or Zetia, and wants me to think over what I would like to do. I'm not inclined to take one of those medications and wonder how troubled I should be by these numbers, and what would you suggest? Thank you for your insight and very helpful program. And this from Liz in Pacific Grove. Well, thank you, Liz. Let me start by saying that in a situation like this, the first thing I recommend is that we actually look at comprehensive lipid testing. Okay, you've failed your screen, but I don't treat people based on their screen, particularly female type people, because all of the screening is based on men and women are different. Now, I'm not happy with your HDL ratio, your ratio for your total cholesterol to your HDL, I mean to say, but I don't know how much HDL you've got. And I don't know what size particles that LDL is. I also don't know about inflammation. I don't know whether you have elevated levels of phospholipase A2, which would indicate that you're forming plaque. I want to emphasize, it's great that you have a negative cardiac calcium score, but that doesn't prove you don't have plaque, because not all plaque calcifies. And if you have no calcium in your breasts, well, you may not be the type of person who calcifies their plaque. The reason we started looking at calcium score was because we saw people with low cholesterol getting heart attacks, and we were trying to figure out what it was. And it turns out that the calcium will deposit in the arteries, and it makes them more likely to rupture. And of course, that's how you have a heart attack. It starts with a plaque that ruptures, and then the platelets jump on, and then you form a blood clot, and we're off to the races, right? Literally, the races. Getting back to you, I would recommend that you get a Cleveland Clinic test. This is available through Quest. There is a what the Cleveland Clinic heart test does. It's very advanced and it's state of the art. It measures things that are signs of inflammation. It looks at your high sensitivity C reactive protein, which your doctor has probably heard of. Your primary care doctor may not know about matrix metalloproteinase. They may not know about phospholipase A2 and some of the other factors that influence the probability of heart disease in marginal situations. Also, the calculated LDL, you want to measure particle size. If your LDL, that's the weight of your LDL. But if your LDL is big fat particles, that's actually better. That LDL is very unlikely to form an atheroma. So if a person has big fat LDL, low inflammation, and normal levels of phospholipase A2, they're not making plaque. They're not actively adding plaque to the system despite that LDL, which would be the case if they had low inflammation and big LDL. So you get a pass. And part of the reason that our ability for this particular type of test to have high predictive value is because a lot of people who screen out positive don't need that statin. And I'm sure since any regular listener will know, statins deplete your CoQ10, and your CoQ10 is extremely important for your brain and your muscles, and for that matter, the heart muscle. So long-term users of high-dose statins who avoid the heart attack because of the anti-inflammatory effect of the statins. See, a misattribution is being made there. It's not the cholesterol level. It's the fact that statins are anti-inflammatory, so they help inflamed people not have heart attacks. By the way, Zetia will get your primary care doctor feeling better because your cholesterol levels will be fine. You, however, won't get any better because there's literally not much good data or only poor data that taking Zetia, although it does lower cholesterol, has anything to do with preventing heart attacks. That's been very difficult to prove because all it does is lower the LDL number, the calculated LDL number, by the way, in all the studies. So you're not going to get a statistically significant result because you're not looking under the right rock. So I hope that's been helpful. If you get those tests and want to send another email, I'd love to talk with you about that. I'd love the opportunity to go into detail about these things on another occasion. But for now, I'm going to sign off and thank you very much for your email. And we're moving on to our next email, the one I really liked from Mark in Seattle. First of all, Mark, thanks for the great topic, because I get to do a science lesson about something people probably don't know much about. I won't say I know a lot about it. I know what I have seen at functional medicine conferences, and I'll share that with you at the end of describing what the heck it is that we're talking about. Glycocalyx. Did you know that the inside of your blood vessel wall has shag carpeting made of sugar on it? Well, guess what? It does. The glycocalyx is a piece of sugar carpeting that's on the cell membranes of certain bacteria. It's on animal cells, and it was discovered in 1970. It's a coating of carbohydrates and some glycolipids, which are sugar fats, and then some glycoproteins, which are sugar proteins. This looks like shag carpeting. And the carbohydrate portion is on the outside, and it's important, very important functionally, to help cells recognize each other, communicate with each other, and stick to each other. It's a type of identifier, for example, that the body uses to distinguish between its own healthy cells and transplanted tissues, diseased cells, or invading organism. And during embryologic development, they're incredibly important to enable cells to stick together and also guide the movement of cells along planes of tissue so that your spinal column can develop, the organs that are made up of multiple layers from that original gastrula can actually go to the right place. An example of that might be, oh, how about your lungs? You know, you've got both endothelium and mesenchyme in those lungs, and if you didn't have both of them, you wouldn't have lungs. Another example that you'll be familiar with of glycocalyx is that slimy stuff on the outside of fish. That's glycocalyx. And what we're going to be talking about for the purposes of Mark's question is the endothelial glycocalyx. And this is on the inside of all the blood vessels, both capillaries, arteries, and veins. It can be up to 11 microns thick. That's pretty thick. That's about almost 2 red blood cells thick. It gets, of course, smaller when you get into the tiny blood vessels because the red blood cells barely manage to squeeze through some of those. It also has a lot of enzymes in it and other proteins that act as signaling proteins. So I'm going to list some of these. Nitric oxide synthesis. This is super important for controlling blood pressure. It's helpful in a lot of things, but when we're talking endothelium, it's the production of nitric oxide that causes the circular muscles of the arterial vasculature to relax. How about superoxide dismutase? This is a free radical sink, something that takes care of oxidative stress. How about angiotensin converting enzyme? Yeah, you may have heard of that one. Also, lipoprotein lipase, the thing that breaks down lipids in your bloodstream that is inhibited by insulin, which is why when people have high levels of insulin and insulin resistance, they have high levels of blood fat. We've also got growth factors, chemokines, which are chemical signals that cause cells to either stick or go somewhere else, and recognition signals called apolipoproteins that attach to fat and cholesterol and allow the liver and the other body tissues, like your fat cells, to recognize what to do with those fats floating by. Another main function of the glycocalyx is to act as a protection against the vascular walls. They're very important, particularly protecting against shear stress. Shear stress is when your heart beats and the blood moves around a corner or comes to a crossroad and it bangs into a wall in the vascular structure, in the vascular tree. That wall is where injury can occur simply from the force of the fluid hitting it over and over and over again on the average of 60 times a minute. Damage is what gets plaque started. So that's a particularly important reason for us to pay attention to glycocalyx. It's also super important in protecting blood clotting in the small blood vessels. Like the capillaries and the smaller blood vessels, it contains antithrombotic factors that prevent clots from getting going. And that's, of course, obviously extremely important. There's a lot of things that can damage the glycocalyx. High blood sugar will do it. Oxidized low-density lipoproteins, we talked about those a moment ago, dealing with Liz's email. That can also be a factor. And in the microvasculature, you can get edema. And in fact, disruption of the glycocalyx is implicated in a type of chronic edema that we often see initially from lymph injury related to cancer therapy. And that lymph edema is very, very disabling. and may be in fact related to glycocalyx as well as the factors we've already identified. I saw a video of glycocalyx. It was a real-time video. It was fascinating. I don't remember how they did it, but they were looking at glycocalyx, and then they put regular blood, fasting blood was running through it, and then they ran blood after different kinds of meals, and you could see the glycocalyx essentially just get ripped off by a meal. Most meals would do it, but the time it took for the glycocalyx, remember it's a protective layer, the time for it to come back varied depending upon the food, which was the purpose of the demonstration. So foods that were high in sugar or saturated fat and foods that were pro-oxidant, which among other things would be sugar and saturated fat, delayed the reconstitution of the glycocalyx. Now, Mark is asking about a supplement that he saw called Arterosil, which claims it's clinically proven to restore the endothelial glycocalyx. And it's a type of green seaweed, Monstroma extract. The advertising says it's rare, but what does that mean? Question mark is Mark's question. And I'm wondering what you thought about it. Not sure how to find the science around it. Just to throw in the last line here. Thank you, Mark. Flattery is always appreciated. I look forward to every podcast you do. Why can't there be such keen and great thinking doctors like you in my area? Thanks for the shout out, Mark. But in answer to your question, I wasn't able to find much research either. It's probably proprietary research because that's kind of the sort of thing that you try to do, right? You try, as I was saying in my editorial, you try to use science to find something you can sell. And that's a corporate kind of approach, but not a pure science approach. And that's why we need to rein in the corporate research. Basically, proprietary research shouldn't continue to get government funding. I think that would be a good way to get started on this. But that's not your question. I think this is not ready for prime time. I don't think they're going to be able to prove that this wouldn't work any better than, oh, any other kind of seaweed, chlorella, spirulina, something that's cheap and readily available would likely have the same benefit. Maybe there's some special molecule here, but until I see a paper that compares it to other seaweeds, or for that matter, kale or spinach or anything with a lot of chlorophyll in it, I'm not convinced. Now, chlorophyll, it might really work to protect glycocalyx, and that's a bit less far-fetched given what we know from the diet studies, which are the only ones I'm aware of that really demonstrate the change in the reconstitution after a meal. We all know it goes away after we eat for a while. Thins out, more accurately. It goes from shag to berber, and then the shag comes back. How long does it take? Well, how much long it takes for your protective raincoat to the inside of your blood vessels to come back is obviously going to be a factor in how long it takes, how much injury you sustain. And by the way, this thing I'm talking about, shear stress, this is the main driver of why hypertension causes heart disease. Now about some useless but fun science, just for a break. In a book recently published called Physics of Fluid, a group from Zurich describes how they applied the science of rheology to the quaint purpose of improving the quality of a cup of black tea. So what's rheology? It's the study of the flow of matter, usually in a liquid or gas state. It's a branch of physics and has lots of practical applications in engineering, geophysics, physiology, biology, pharmaceuticals, material science, mainly for the manufacture of products. But what am I talking about? Well, everything from cement to paint to chocolate is influenced by rheology. You don't want your cement factory pipes clogging up, that's for sure. So in this research, they looked at something called an interfacial phenomenon, the two faces, the face of the air and the face of the tea, in a cup of tea that was left to cool after steeping. Under certain circumstances, you get a thin film at the air-water interface. Sometimes you can even see it. I'm going to try this when I get home with black tea and hard water. So you get a little film, and when the film is disturbed, you can actually see cracks like sea ice. So this sounds like a fun home science project. I'm going to try it tonight. using something called interfacial rheology, they assessed the mechanical properties of the film. And they looked at water hardness, acidity, sugar, milk, tea concentration, and brewing temperature. And the way they do this is they put a little mechanical stirrer at the surface of the tea, and they very slowly rotate it. And they see the resistance to rotation that they get from the film allows them to determine the strength of the film. And the film was always thought to be like a residual waxy coating from tea leaves. But back in the 1990s, researchers disproved this, and it's like, no, it's actually calcium carbonate, basically lime, that contributes to the compounds that react with the tea compounds and form this film. It's a spontaneous, I won't call it a biofilm because it's not produced by bacteria, but if I were a bacteria, I'd look at that particular film and I'd say, I wonder if I could grow on that. Oh, wait, that's kombucha. Oops. So you see, it really does have practical significance. Tap water comes from mostly limestone aquifers a lot of the time, and calcium carbonate will get into the water. But many homes have water softeners to reduce that in their water supply because they don't want it building up on the faucets. But you know what you'll get also is your tea will taste more bitter. I'm going to have to check this out because I have a reverse osmosis. And it says here, if you make a cup of tea in perfectly pure water, it won't form a film, but it'll taste much more bitter if you steep it for, say, 5 minutes. Researchers found conditions contributing to the strongest film, that is to say, hardened water, might be useful in packaged tea beverages or emulsion stabilization of milk tea. And they might, doing it in pure water would probably be better if you were going to do, like, instant tea. But anything acidic basically reduces the visibility of the film and adds a lot of flavor. But I thought, I'm going to have to try this bitter water film. Is the tea more bitter? I know how to do this. This is like your junior high science project. Children, try this at home. All right, our next story tonight. Researchers have observed an association between standing and insulin sensitivity. Standing more may actually help prevent diabetes. And we've known for a long time that insulin is a key hormone. We talk about it all the time on this program. And we know that insulin function in the body can be disturbed by being overweight, causing decreased insulin sensitivity and higher insulin levels, higher blood sugar, more cardiovascular disease, and more diabetes. Standing is actually associated with better insulin sensitivity. And this is true also for people who are sedentary. Now, we've known for a long time there are associations between insulin resistance and sedentary behavior, and that physical activity and fitness are important for avoiding developing type 2 diabetes. So these researchers were already looking at that, and they included not exercising more, but just standing. And of course, the advent of standing desks probably made this easier. What they found was that while increased body fat percentage was very important in terms of insulin sensitivity, and it was more important than physical activity, fitness, or the amount spent sitting. So in other words, your body fat percentage was the big factor there. But standing was associated with insulin sensitivity independently. It didn't matter how much you weighed or what your body fat composition was. We know regular exercise is good, but it looks like regular standing, regardless of weight, makes a difference in insulin resistance. And this is not what we would call exercise. So let's all get standing desks, by the way. I am a real convert to that. My neck hurts less. All of the sort of mild but annoying aches and pains in my upper body and shoulders improved enormously when I got a standing desk. And the only downside of it was that I started to get a little leg swelling at the end of the day, and I had to pay more attention to arch support. Well worth it for the improvement in my normal functioning. Here's a related story. It's actually never too late to get active. This was a study coming from the European Society of Cardiology. This was presented. The researcher is Natalia Gonzalez at the University of Bern in Switzerland. It was 33,000 patients with known coronary artery disease. The average age was 62, 34% were women. They followed them for about 7 years. They used active and inactive. For moderate intensity, it was active. It was 150 minutes a week of moderate intensity. That's like walking, doing laundry, light housekeeping, or 75 minutes a week of vigorous activity. Vigorous activity is probably running, lifting weights, swimming, things like that. They're divided into four groups, and then they followed them and watched what happened over time. So if they increased their activity over time, they fell into one category. If they decreased activity over time, they fell into another category. And then there were two more categories, those that didn't change much. Those who were active over all the time had 50% lower risk of mortality, all-cause mortality, which that could just be because the people who are sicker are less active, right? So that could be a confound. However, those who were inactive but became active had a 45% lower risk of heart disease. And that's significant to me. That means that you can get back the benefit of lifelong exercise. It's just important to move your body. Now, that was all-cause mortality. When we talk about cardiovascular disease, remaining active, you were 50% lower than the cohort who was inactive. And if you became active, you got 27% lower. So you don't get as much benefit as you get from lifelong exercise, but you get a big chunk of benefit. Definitely think about taking a walk, taking a break, and taking a walk on the break. Most of us could actually manage that if we put an alarm in our phone or worked it into our schedule. Particularly if you're working from home, it's an absolutely wonderful idea to schedule an extra 10 minutes between the online sessions and do some jumping jacks, run in place, whatever you can do. But take a movement break. It's so important. And you'll notice that your pain is substantially less if you're getting those sorts of, you know, classic low back, neck, shoulder, elbow, wrist, numbness, tingling, carpal tunnel, et cetera, et cetera. They'll all get better if you take a movement break. This one, cool science on dental implants. I pulled this one to the top of the pile because I just finished talking to my dentist about dental implants, and I'm not going to wait to get one. It's probably going to be another 10 years before this technology is approved, but it's exciting technology, both for dental implants, but also for joint replacements, because when things get infected, when a joint replacement gets infected, that's nasty. A dental implant, you can yank relatively easily, but an infected joint replacement could have major surgery as a penalty. Dental implants don't last as long as joints. Sometimes they need replacement within 5 years. Mostly that's due to local inflammation and gum disease. This new implant uses a nanoparticle-infused material that resists bacterial colonization, and it has an embedded light source that conducts phototherapy that is powered by the natural motions of the mouth, such as chewing or toothbrushing. So, you know the old self-winding watches? Well, imagine if chewing caused your tooth to produce light, which changed the friendliness of that foreign body in your mouth, that is to say the implant, to colonization by bacteria. They used a piezoelectric material. It's sort of in the old radios that they had a crystal in them. And if you squeeze a crystal, you get electricity. If you apply mechanical motion to a crystal, you get electricity. If you apply electricity to a crystal, you get mechanical motion. It's very small, but it's enough to actually make for a transfer from the electric world to the actual physical world. A very, very valuable thing. Now, they're using a compound called barium titanate, and it's very widely used in capacitors and transistors, but it hasn't been approved for use as an implantable biomaterial. The early research showed that the material generates a negative surface charge. Just the small amount of electricity you create repels, like a force field, repels the negatively charged cell walls of bacteria. And this is something that's going to last forever. This is not like a chemical that's going to eventually be broken down in the body. This is intrinsic to the molecular structure of the implant. In tests over time, they did not see leaching of the materials. I'm not sure. Obviously, they didn't test the materials for 10 years, and there's a lot of time that would be needed to prove its safety in the mouth. But when I say a lot of time, you know, 4 to 5 years if they get funding. And certainly the implications for joint replacement surgery are huge. And we talk about science a lot on this program and the scientific method. And also, I started the program talking about ideas and how we need to be able to float ideas, postulate them, propose them, invent products that are based on them, and then we have to be able to abandon these ideas. A recent study looked at treating schizophrenia, or rather analyzing schizophrenia using genetic information. There are over 300 genes, gene variants that have been associated with schizophrenia. So what we do is we create these polygenic risk scores. So how many hits do you have of genes that are associated with schizophrenia? Large studies have validated this, showing that if you have schizophrenia, looking back and look at your risk scores, yes, you have a higher genetic risk score. But the opposite is not necessarily true. If you have a higher genetic risk score, you may or may not actually have schizophrenia. What they did was they looked at 760 schizophrenic patients, and they looked at whether there was any predictive value for the score, anything better than what you could get from just reading the medical record. And basically, no, there isn't. Even though the ones with the highest associations, aggressive behavior and the need for hospitalizations, the doctor with a pencil and or a pen and paper could figure that out just as well as the genetic risk score. It added nothing. That's an idea that needs to be abandoned, and that's science in action. I have a really quick one. It's drink enough water. You can prevent heart failure over time if you drink enough fluid, and that's about 1.5 to 2 quarts for women or 2 to 3 quarts for men. And this was a big study, the Atherosclerosis Risk in Communities study. And what they looked at people from the age of 70 to the age of 90, and the people who drank lots of water had less heart failure. They had better sodium concentration. Their heart didn't have to work as hard. And guess what? Over 20 years, the fact that their heart and kidneys didn't have to work as hard actually made a difference in their risk of developing heart failure. So I feel like that's news you can use. Dr. Don says, get your flu shot, drink your fluids, and come back next week for more of Ask Dr. Don. Until then, so long and stay healthy. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDon.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDon. For now, this is Dr. Don saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Don is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.